Future Friday.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Future Friday. I'm here with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. For this week's episode, we'll be talking about the future of agriculture or farming. So agriculture or farming is a very big topic, especially what's going on right now with COVID-19. It's a very big issue. So, John, what are the sort of trends going on with agriculture and farming right now?
Well, the big things are that we have a growing population, a growing middle class with changing dietary needs, and we also have less and less land to actually do it. So, we have to find different ways of feeding more people with fewer resources. And those are the kinds of big challenges facing us that will dictate what kind of things we have to do. So a big kind of changes are different ways of farming and finding different ways to produce food. So things like, say, Beyond Meat and other alternative meats can definitely help offset demand for cattle, which has quite the environmental impact. And with a growing global middle class, as more people are able to afford beef, which was once a luxury meat, everyone's going to want to start eating beef, but that's not quite good for the environment.
Yeah, it seems quite similar to, our construction discussion. The fact there's obviously a growing population, meaning we need to build more houses and more infrastructure, but obviously that's going to cause environmental damage. With the agriculture argument, it's kind of similar because there's a growing population, there needs to be a way to try and meet that. And if that's through, let's say, automation, because I think automation is definitely mentioned in this topic. So it just shows the fact a growing population is impacting all types of sectors, like agriculture, but also we've mentioned construction quite massively.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's they have similar environmental impacts. They're both huge consumers of water, huge consumers of land area, and huge producers of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. So they are things that we need in order to survive. So it's just a matter of how do we meet our own needs without necessarily destroying everything around us.
No, definitely. And it's the fact, what you just mentioned about, the growing of, using less meat and more kind of alternatives. So let's say more plant-based alternatives and, even cultured meats is a quite big one. What people don't know, actually, do you know a bit more about cultured meats? Maybe you know a bit more than me. But yeah, what is cultured meats to everyone who doesn't really know what that is?
I mean, I'm no expert, but off the top of my head, these are basically lab grown. Well, there's different ways of going about it. There's things like Beyond Meat, which are plant-based, which are basically they've arranged the composition of cellulose and other molecules in such a way so as it replicates the texture and taste of meat. And of course, it just has to have protein and a similar nutritional contents. But it's at its fundamental level, it's really just plant. And there's other options such as, say, having actual real meat grown in a test tube or a petri dish in some laboratory, where it's being, synthetically and artificially kept alive. And you just, you could tell these meat cells to simply just grow infinitely, and you just keep cutting off slices of meat or grow it into specific kinds of tendons and muscles to replicate those kinds of body parts. There's many different ways in which we can go about it. Either find an alternative for the meat or finding a different way of creating it entirely. And these can be much better at, these really could help, change a lot of positions in that there are ways for us to kind of maintain our current diets without necessarily having to have the negative impacts we see now, because these could be, you know, grown with, you know, it's basically like cows, for example, are very inefficient at turning feed into like actual meat. Like very few, like very little of the food they actually have to, they intake and energy they process actually goes towards turning into meat. This could just be, you know, all the resources you put into it go directly to creating meat, using only a fraction of it. Like you don't have to support a heart, a brain, or any of all that. It's just that it's, you have a different ethical question of, you know, you're not necessarily killing an animal, but you're kind of keeping cells alive in a weird kind of way, which is a bit different, which is a different ethical question, but it definitely allows people to say, you know, kind of eat meat and combine it with, you know, say things like veganism. To speak anecdotally, I had a friend who's a vegan, and the first time she ate Beyond Meat, she had her body reacted similarly as she did to eating regular meat, because the texture was so similar, her body thought she was eating actual meat, but in reality it wasn't.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's really, wow. That's really, it's quite bad that then. Because yeah, no, that does sound pretty, especially bad for like a vegan as well.
Well, bad initially, because they're not used to eating it. It's kind of like, hey,
yeah, where true, actually.
But it really, that's a sign that, you know, we can actually create something that has very few of the same kind of negative impacts as raising an actual cow, but is actually able to substitute for, like, it's good enough to fill the body of a vegan and to its real meat.
And also, like, of what I've looked into, there's something called, like, you know, Fitbits. Fitbits are even looking into being used for like animals as well. And I think, like, even though, yes, we're talking about, you know, growing meat like through like cultured and things like that, I think the slight issue with the meat industry is because a lot of the meat industry is, let's say, through like factory farming and things like that. It's not actually the meat itself. It's the way it's kind of, I don't want to say like produced or like killed. And then having these Fitbits apparently kind of helps to like measure how healthy the cow is, what if it has disease, if it's becoming feeling ill, if it's like fertile, and things like that. So I feel like maybe Fitbits could actually help produce better meat a little bit more naturally through like killing the animal rather than producing, you know, these kind of bodies.
Yeah, there's definitely ways for... Yeah, no, there's definitely, it's definitely, you know, what is it that they say that sometimes... It depends, like the way in which you kill the animal matters, because, you know, the kind of stress that the animal feels can kind of taint the meat in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is, and it's also, you know, the ethical question of like, how do we raise these animals, make sure that they're happy and comfortable, and not just, you know, make them have their own lives beyond just existing to be consumed by us. So yeah, those things are definitely helpful for the smaller scale farming, but that's there's a different thing. Some of the problems with factory farming is that some of the problems we face is that factory farming is, you know, purely economic and resource terms efficient, in the sense that it's uses a lot less area than, say, open range and better for the animals. So we have to find something that doesn't involve factory producing animals without turning, you know, a 1 kilometer, you know, 1 square kilometer factory into a 10 square kilometer grazing field.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you've also got, this is not to sound like, what's the word, because obviously there's, you know, these like wet markets as well that have been happening in like the Northwest. It's like even those kind of things are pretty bad. I think what my concern is, even though I'm not saying that eating meat is completely and utterly healthy, I'm not saying it is, I just think it's the type of meat we eat and how the meat is produced that I think a lot of people get their heads a bit mixed around with. Because I just saw someone do like this article which was saying why meat causes cancer. And I was like, wait a sec, no, that's very like inaccurate, because it's actually processed meat. It's the way an animal's been brought up. And I think instead of criticizing, and don't get me wrong, I think the meat industry does need to be criticized. I just think it's the way we kind of produce it. So like things like tackling, you know, factory farming, maybe tackling like wet markets, for example, that have been a lot in the question right now in the media in like China and things like that. So I think it's definitely the way we produce meat should definitely be looked into, investigated, if you agree or disagree with that.
Well, of course, it's how we produce the meat. That's the whole question, is how are we producing the food that we need? Are we producing it in a way that is, you know, we can make it in a test tube, and it could be a fraction of the price and a fraction of the resources, or we can, you know, put it, you know, spend, have fields and fields and fields of grazing cows, you know, hanging out with their best friends, and then you have or we could have cows. Cow is the same as, you know, it's not like beef is the same as pork or the same as chicken. All going to be different. We can't lump it all together.
Yeah, no, that's true. But yeah, no, I agree. It's just like, it's a way of, yeah, you can't just loop everything together.
The wet markets, I'm not sure how much of them they actually contribute to, like how much meat is actually produced or consumed through a wet market.
Yeah, that's the thing, because I think there's a lot of mixed reports of what types of animals are there in those markets. That's the thing, because I think I was watching one Vox video which was showing all kinds of animals can be in there. But of course, I think it depends what it is. But no, that's fair enough. I mean, we have been speaking a lot about, you know, the meat industry and the way of our changing eating methods, or, you know, I don't know how you categorize it. But like, what other kind of trends are impacting the agriculture industry? Because I feel like mechanization has definitely impacted a lot. Do you want to talk a bit more about that, John?
Mechanization, sure. This is an industry that went from employing, what, like 90% of people for centuries to fewer than 5%?
Yeah, something like that. I know in America, it was like in the 1900s, it was about a good majority of workers were working on these farms in America. And now it's about barely below 5%. It's like below 5% now. So yeah,
I mean, it's an industry that's been seeing continuous mechanization since, like, that's basically the Industrial Revolution, is how do we better produce food? I mean, that's one aspect. I mean, in the post-World War II, we had a big kind of agricultural revolution, with combine harvesters, new fertilizers, new different ways of, you know, creating our food. So yeah, it's a long ongoing trend, the employing of fewer and fewer people in agriculture. I guess something to similar to mirror the meat industry is the fact that you also have to, you know, crops aren't exactly great for the environment either, in the sense that the practice of monoculture can be quite detrimental to the environment. You can, it's also the matter of pesticides, pesticides and herbicides can help, on the one hand, keep food, you know, free from pests and protect crops, but it could have, you know, long-term detrimental effects on our health. You need to have genetic diversity in our crops. We can't have them all be genetically the same, because if you have one bug or something go through it, you can have entire cultures wiped out, which can be very bad. One bad, this can be quite, you know, really bad for everywhere. And we need to have, of course, you know, water consumption, how much water is being consumed. So there are plenty of, we have to find new ways of creating our food. Maybe it's not all made in a field, you know, with sun, with bright like blue skies and sunny days.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. It's it's like the whole kind of idea of like climate replication, and even like vertical farming. I don't know if you've heard of this term, but vertical farming is something that has been looked into as well. I think it's only lettuce and basil where they've been tested, and they've seen the most profitable out of this kind of type of farming. So yeah, things like trying to create the climate, like let's say you're in England and you're trying to grow an avocado, it's like trying to create that same environment as if the avocado is growing in like a South American region. So I think definitely that kind of type of technology is increasing. But I think it definitely would help, I think, both for farmers and for the environment hugely, kind of things like that.
Oh yeah. Well, that will be the future. Is going to be, you know, urban vertical hydroponics. Creating, you know, hydroponics is basically just floating, creating or growing crops in water, which doesn't really have soil, can be a very different way of doing things, but can also be very efficient in terms of resources and water. Then you can stack them all vertically, and you know, instead, because that's one big issue with traditional agriculture is you just have one field.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like why we have, like, that's why apartments are more efficient and environmentally friendly than, say, single family dwellings, because you can just, it's not just the land, the four walls on the initial ground floor, but all the floors you can put up is exponentially the amount of, linearly increase the amount of land area in that. So we can do the same with, you know, we can create, have one level of agriculture, hydroponics, whatever, and then just stack them on top of each other and put them in an urban center, and boom, you've gotten rid of rural sprawl, and now you have food security directly inside the city in a way that's much where the food can be more quickly distributed to those who need it, and taking up only a fraction of the water and land area that it once did.
Mm.
Like, for example, there's one example is, say, it's basically an algae reactor. So how it essentially works is it's cultures of algae kept in conditions that are optimal for photosynthesis. So they always have, you know, just the right amount of light, just the right amount of nutrients, and just the right amount of heat all the time. So the algae is always growing constantly. And the water, you know, all the water that goes in is directly to the algae. And if you provide the energy in a clean way, so these reactors are initially tested in Iceland. So they use their geothermal energy, because photosynthesis requires carbon dioxide. If all the energy is created in a green way, then it's a carbon negative process. The algae will then take out carbon dioxide in its photosynthesis, continually grow. And this algae has nutritional contents similar to that of soybeans. So it takes up, you know, to produce, you know, 1 ton of algae with nutritional content similar to 1 ton of beans, it takes, you know, a fraction of a percentage of the amount of water and just as much land area. And these things can be, they can run 24 hours a day, independent of day and night cycles. They can be put up pretty much anywhere. You can, so long as you have water and the necessary nutrients, you can put up in a desert, you can put it in a rainforest, you can put it anywhere, stack them on top of each other and put it inside of a city. And while they're still looking into whether that kind of algae is something that can be consumed by humans, it's something that could be used for, say, animal feed. Because, 80% of global soybean production goes towards feeding our animals, feeding our food rather than ourselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the kind of thing that could be, you know, you could expand it to something like, carrots or whether or even other kinds of foods that we could look into, you know, finding other ways of producing the same things we once have.
Yeah, no, definitely. And your kind of idea about certain foods that we feed to our animals, even like insects are becoming a bit more investigated as well. So I know you did like a weak signal, I think, on one of the episodes about it was like bug butter, I think it was, or
yeah,
something yeah, like that. Yeah. So it's like, yeah.
Butter from bugs.
Yeah, sorry, my bad. But yeah, like that kind of thing. So I think it just shows that, there's loads of different things. And how have these kind of trends come about? Like, why have we became a bit more, let's say, like environmentally aware in terms of our food? Like, yeah, like how have these trends kind of come about? What do you say?
Well, I guess, I mean, we partly have the large social trends changing how we view our relationship with the world and with the land. You know, we're not necessarily the same kind of agricultural societies that view, you know, land in terms, you know, cultivated land is good productive land and uncultivated land is something that needs to be harnessed and controlled. We're having a different relationship to animals and to nature, you know, whether or not we view ourselves, you know, other forms of life as something that exists for our exploitation or something that, you know, coexists with us. We have, and we, you know, we have all these changing attitudes towards animals in general, changing animal rights. We have, you know, emerging different kinds of diets. We have vegetarianism and veganism are on the rise. You know, people are reevaluating how they once did because food is something that's is very much a cultural staple and is something that's hard to change. It's not something that kind of, you know, disappears just like that. It's something that we have to slowly reevaluate. And I think as people, you know, reevaluate their lives and what their values are, they're starting to reevaluate their relationship, you know, with the things they need.
And sometimes they, as well, like these kind of new changes in diets, sometimes they just come out of nowhere. I don't know. I find they come out of nowhere a little bit. It's like vegetarianism, veganism, all those kind of things. I feel like even though, yes, we cared a bit more like over the past number of years, we've cared more about the animals more and more. But I feel like the whole topic of veganism or like vegetarianism did come out of like nowhere. I don't know. Like I don't see there was no sort of, I can't really find a trigger for why that kind of changed.
Well, it's not really like it's a trigger. I mean, these are ideas that have existed long before. I mean, there are plenty of religious movements that, you know, it depends on what we think of our place in the world and where do we place ourselves with it. You can take a look at, say, Jains in India, who believe that all life is sacred and is equal and has equal value, all forms of life. You know, they adhere to strict veganism because they do not believe that you can harm any form of life, including you know, these are people that don't walk, you know, very carefully walk where they step because they don't want to step on an insect. So it's, and these are, you know, religions that have existed for centuries. So it's not like the idea of, or say, for example, you know, many of, you know, to bring up the Nazis, you know, many people in, you know, Hitler's inner circle were quite interested in vegetarianism and quite progressive in terms of their relationship, had a different relationship to the land than some of their contemporaries. So it's not like these ideas are new, but it's a result of how we're thinking of our place in the world.
Yeah.
It's the ideas that shape how we interact with these things. Once those ideas are changing, our interactions start to change. Because it doesn't really make sense for you to think that all life is equal and, you know, you and human beings don't have a right to play God and decide who gets to live and who gets to die, but at the same time, you know, blindly, you know, raising an entire species that pretty much solely exists to feed you in horrendous conditions. You know, that's, you can't have that at the same time. That's a contradiction.
Yeah. No, it's interesting how Hitler was a vegetarian. I don't know. I'm not saying it was interesting, but like, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, it's quite odd. But
he really liked German shepherds, but not like, say, I don't know, other dogs. He liked his German shepherds.
Yeah, definitely. Fair enough. But definitely. And I don't know, like, we've seen a lot of these, obviously, changes, but like, what would you say is the biggest factor in the changes of the agriculture industry? And what I've put down in terms of these factors, would you say it's either technology kind of improving? So of course we've seen, you know, more and more automation enter agriculture. It's been seen throughout history. Maybe the growing population with the need for more food. So I think that could be a recent factor. Also labor shortages, I can't say that right, has come into play as well. The fact that I've seen, I know there's a recent story that happened in the UK where they had to fly in quite a few, I think Europeans into the agriculture culture, into the agricultural sort of industry. So because they were running out of farmers and running out of pickers. So they had to get them in. So that's another factor. Or even, you know, what we've been speaking about, you know, changing of like changing of values, becoming more environmentally aware, becoming a bit more like, you know, veganism. So yeah, in terms of those kind of factors, what is the biggest factor in that change, in changing that agriculture industry, if that makes sense?
I'm not sure whether we can really tie it down to one factor, because they're all so interconnected.
Course.
You know, the only reason why you produce food is because people need food, so people, you know, so you have to produce it. There's demand for that, and then, you know, it's new ways of producing food and new technologies that can also help enable and change our relationship to the different kind of ideas that shape our ways of consumption. Like, if you grow in a society that basically just raises like pork and eats a whole lot of pork, you know, it's hard for you to imagine a world where you eat something that's not pork and you eat, but if you can see a way of producing synthetic pork, then you can suddenly imagine like, oh, I can have my pork and eat it too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's those kinds of, they all interplay with each other and change what's possible. Because people have always, and even just like in terms of like growing populations, you know, what was it? Thomas Malthus said in the late 1700s that food is the limit of where, you know, that we are at the limit of population. You know, population will grow until food supplies don't, until supplies run out, then the poor people will basically reproduce until they can't feed themselves anymore.
Pretty much.
Saying that for what, 200 years? And at that point, and the population is what? Nearly 7.5 billion now?
Yeah. And I think the population
wasn't even a billion then. Like, we've been saying these, like, we have these considerations of what is, you know, the limits of food, but we keep surpassing them.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like, you know, more and more people say like our food security is becoming less secure, but then somehow we still the world population still continues to grow. I saw something I saw an article that was saying, even though our population will grow, it will grow quite slowly. I think it was by the United Nations, I think. So that was interesting. But yeah, I definitely think those.
It's not like populations growing evenly everywhere across the world. While the world is able to feed itself, food security, like, there's a different question in terms of like, because if you import the vast majority of your food, yet you're not food secure. You don't have food sovereignty. But yeah. if you're a country that, you know, is a net exporter of food, if you're like the Netherlands, then yeah, you're all set.
Absolutely.
But if you're, say, the UK that imports a lot of food, then yeah, you don't have the same level of food security.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, no, definitely.
But it's these kinds of new innovations that, say, detach food production from environmental conditions and from, you know, weather and all that. Those things can help give different countries their food security and give themselves food sovereignty. You know, can you imagine a world where Saudi Arabia could feed itself?
Yeah, no, exactly. I can imagine a world where we don't even have to do globalization anymore. We could do like reverse globalization, where you kind of grow all your kinds of food that you need all locally through these climate replication places. You know, that would be such a cool world to kind of live in.
Well, it seems to be the way things will be going is more domestic production.
I mean, definitely for now, especially what's going on right now.
Well, I mean, in longer term, like globalization works. I mean, globalization worked for a while, but then it's kind of, if manufacturing can be as simple as, say, just 3D printing something or growing a culture of some bacteria, you don't need it all to be centralized in one location that gets distributed everywhere else in the world. You don't have that same need of capital. When the capital is so low, it's basically just a computer and a special kind of printer, or something that can easily be invested in by a community, then you don't need to have it be, you know, you don't need these kinds of long supply chains. If the supply chain's local, you don't need to move things around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the thing of the whole point of trade is you have something I need that I don't have here. But if I have everything here that I need, I don't need to trade with you for those things. Mm. And if anything, it's these kinds of situations like right now that demonstrate that you might want to produce certain things domestically, that, yeah, there might be some kind of, one other country might have a comparative advantage and might be able to produce something better than you can. But, you know, there's certain things you might want to produce on your own, like your own food, your own medicine, your own certain kinds of infrastructure. You don't want to make sure that you're reliant on other countries to produce everything that you need in order to, you know, do your life.
Yeah, it would definitely, be a way of, what you've said, like maintain like those countries themselves actually getting some sovereignty over their food, and a way to actually, be able to not rely on another country. It will be very interesting in how that will then change trade and how that would impact globalization. I think it will be very interesting to see when our world becomes like this, definitely. But then what kind of challenges is agriculture facing though? That's another question I think we should definitely address.
Well, I think the big ones are that we have a growing population, growing global population that's going to require more food. And of course, the environmental considerations. We need to produce more, but we somehow need to use less space to do it.
Mm.
Because we can't keep cutting down the Amazon forest for cattle farming.
Yeah. And it's a way, it's just trying to find a way of, balancing it. Because, that's the thing. It's like, what do you do? And even questions of like, you know, do you tell people to eat less meat? Do you produce less meat? Do you make meat more expensive? Do you look at alternatives? Do you introduce, insects into diets? There's so many different ideas of trying to find a way to produce less, but also trying to address the growing need
of
the population. It's very hard.
That's the thing is you don't give it one answer. It's you take the multi-pronged approach. It's all the little things that add up, all the little changes. that slowly, everyone, all the individual changes that people make as they slowly, you know, decide, hey, maybe I don't want to try, maybe I'll want to have lentils for dinner today. Maybe I don't want to have pork, or, you know, maybe yeah. I will try the Beyond Burger today and not the regular meat patty.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of little steps that we can take that will, on aggregate, slowly, that can, you know, increase our food production while at the same time decreasing its environmental impact. But mm-hmm. it is a matter of also, you know, enabling those choices and facilitating them and educating people on, like, hey, you know, think for yourself and think, and, you know, think about what you value and what you like. You know, do you like your animals? Okay, well, what do you think about all these, you know, think about the food you eat, think about the impact it has, and think about whether you want to, you know, have a greater impact than what you desire.
Yeah. The only thing with that, though, is what I sometimes do get a bit annoyed with. I'm not saying what environmentalists or veganists try and say. I don't know if veganist is the right word, but you know what I mean. Like, the thing is, even though, yes, they maybe are correct in saying, yes, look at what you're doing. Like, do you consider, if you have all these animals and you're eating different types of animals, and, you know, you need to consider it. But I feel like there needs to be a way of not sounding preachy about it, and not trying to force people to change their diets very, like, forcefully. I think it needs to be a way of educating it, but well, not doing. Yeah, you need. That's the thing.
It's
find
education, yeah. And it's also about, like, it's not a matter like people need. It's yeah. There's a difference between evangelizing and just saying, like, hey, yeah, did you know cattle is, you know, contribute, you know cows burp 8% of the world's greenhouse gases, like. Yeah. There's those things. And of course, it's also just a matter of facilitating and not hindering the developments of these kinds of things. Like, say, like, the meat lobby is quite keen in Canada to not, or in the United States, to not call Beyond Meat a meat alternative, because they insist, like, it's not really meat, so you can't call it that. You have to call it, like, a plant-based meat alternative.
Yeah.
And so it's like those kinds of things that, you know, make it harder for these things to sell and to gain traction in the market by artificially protecting older industries. You know, it's those kinds of things that will make it unnecessarily more difficult for these things to take off, because you're protecting older vested interests.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think it's just even if you have the will to change something, it's trying to implement it with very difficult what will be the future of aquaculture? You know, I think it's probably going to be, you know, what, mechanization. It's probably going to be a lot more plant-based alternatives, or less, you know, things like that. So yeah, what would you say the future of aquaculture is?
Well, I think I described it earlier in, you know, vertical hydroponic urban farming.
Yeah.
You know, seeing, you know, growing, I think it'll be a lot more common for people in the future, maybe, I don't know, let's say in 2050, to think of, when they think of food production, they don't think of a farmer with a pitchfork and, you know, his blue overalls and whatever. And a straw hat. It's not, that won't be the thing that come to mind, but rather, you know, people in laboratories with test tubes and working on gene sequencing and artificially creating food in laboratories. I think that'll be the future, creating, you know, finding new ways of creating, you know, the same tastes and the same textures with wildly different ingredients and components, and with vastly different environmental requirements.
Yeah, and in fact, that's and probably more of a less people on the fields, a lot more like drones, maybe more like unmanned vehicles as well. I think
if there are fields at all, but
if there are fields at all, yeah.
But I think more traditional agriculture that actually involves cultivating a field will become a. I mean, that's the main way food is produced now, but I can see it being a lot less than it will be, taking a much less area, because you'll need, if you can basically feed an entire city in like one tower or an entire, if you can feed a city in one tower, then you don't really need all the sprawling fields around that city to feed it. But of course, not everywhere is going to have that, and there will be people who, there will still be demand, and for those kinds of older, people are going to want every now and then to have, maybe people will still want veal or want other ways of, more traditional meats. It might be a luxury, but it will still exist. But it's simply not at this point in time, and unless there's other ways of radically increasing its production capacity, it's simply not efficient enough to meet our needs.
Definitely. Yeah. It's interesting. It'll be a very interesting future to see for agriculture. This has been a good discussion. We'll now go to the week signals. John, what's your week signal then for this week?
Right. I've got one about a protein that can replace people's workouts, or might be able to replace our workouts.
Cool.
So at the beginning of this year, scientists found the protein sestrin to be responsible for a lot of the physiological benefits of exercise. So in a lab test, they found flies with overexpressed sestrin levels had superior abilities even without exercise compared to trained flies with average sestrin levels. Similarly, mice without sestrin didn't display improved aerobic capacity, respiration, or the fat burning associated with exercise. So that means, having a sestrin deficiency doesn't give you those benefits. So it can also, and sestrin can also help prevent muscle atrophy when they're immobilized for long periods, like when a person's wearing a cast. So it's kind of like that's the protein that's responsible for basically our muscles doing things. Now, it's not like we have a pill on the horizon anyway. It's a large and complex molecule that's difficult to synthesize, but it does present a lot of, present many ideas. The idea of a get fit quick solutions is a long-standing and seductive fantasy, just as much as get rich quick.
Yeah.
And while it doesn't like say that we haven't found that kind of solution, we may be on the cusp of seeing some more pharmaceutical and other kind of therapies in the future that do kind of benefits it, which challenges our assumptions of no effort, no gain, no pain, no gain, and to find how much we can cheat on, use these kinds of cheats to give ourselves benefits without having to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And it can definitely be used in, say, physically demanding professions like construction, nursing, emergency first responders, or in the armed forces. Its impact on innate athletic ability also raises questions about, how do we use it in competitive sports?
That's the thing. I'm kind of like, not too sure about this. I think it would be good for like essential workers, maybe like construction, nurses, doctors, all those kind of people. But then it's like, what if everyone had it? That's my thing. I think it goes against natural biology and all that. And it's your way of saying like pain, like no pain, no gain, or things like that. I think it definitely. Yeah, I'm not too sure about it.
But if these are already naturally occurring proteins in the human body, to what extent is it really, doing something different, or like taking iron when you have an iron deficiency? Like, how is it really so different from that? But at the same time, we have a similar kind of controversy what was it? There was a woman who was, I think she was a sprinter or something, in some, I think it was like the Winter Olympics or something. And they were like, they had, there was controversy over whether allowing her to compete because she had high, she had naturally higher testosterone levels than most women do.
Ah, okay.
The controversy was like, oh, well, like, can she really compete as a woman because she has so much testosterone? It's not like she's taking testosterone.
Yeah.
That's like her her body naturally produces this. So it's not like humans are all at the same level of naturally producing sestrin. Some people clearly have higher levels on their own while others don't. So to what extent is it really like, if no one, so if there's no sestrin, if people aren't doing anything at all, to what extent are we really on a level playing field already?
Yeah, no, it's exactly. It's like, yeah, it's the fact some people might just be naturally better than everyone. So it's like, yeah, no, it's interesting. It's very, very interesting.
You know, it's like those people who, yeah, you know, who are fit and barely work out while all those, you know, other people do a ton and don't really, and don't see the same kind of gains.
Mm. So it's like trying to find a way to level the playing field pretty much, which is,
yeah, I mean, you could always, I mean, if we can say in the future, we can imagine, let's say, you could always see there's the natural leagues where people aren't going to do whatever. And maybe you might have a regulated league where people have, maybe everyone's regulated to have the same sestrin level. So it's all,
yeah,
purely, purely skill and not, and to minimize any kind of, genetic, benefits or hindrances other people might have.
Yeah. No, that does sound interesting. A lot of like different questions as well to be asked about this subject, and something very, yeah, it sounds a really interesting
week. It's a matter of access to it. Like who gets it?
Yeah.
Who gets it? Does it cost much? Cause of course, yeah, it's going to be class issues. Cause you know, it's the poor who have to work and don't necessarily have the time to exercise and already have, you know, poor diets. You know, it can really help compound or exacerbate health inequalities where, you know, the wealthy who are, you know, living their nice sedentary lives, you know, have their nice six packs because they can afford to take a pill for it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like who can, yeah. Yeah. That's yeah, very big questions of it. I'm not too sure if I'm completely supportive of this. I think it'll be great for some people. I just don't know if it would be.
Well, it even depends good on whether it's, yeah, something that can be publicly available or whether it's just like, you know, is it something you can get over the counter, or will it be something like, okay, you're in a cast, here, take sestrin for a couple weeks while you're in the cast, your arm doesn't wither away.
Yeah, of course.
They may keep it for its medical applications, but yeah, who know, we have no idea. It's up to us to determine whether we want to how we want it to work, what we also need. Yeah, we need to see what it can do and where we can go with it.
Absolutely. So yeah, shall I go to my weak signal then?
By all means.
Yes. So to disseminating and dispelling disinformation. Wow, that's a lot of D's in that. So researchers at the University of North Carolina have tried to attempt to create a model about how pieces of information travel through social networks and the Internet of Things. And it's basically trying to find a way of seeing how long it takes for old or like false information to be replaced with newer and more correct information. So sounds like a very interesting model that has been tested or been trialing out in the University of North Carolina. So yeah, why is it pretty important? Because I think, you know, it's trying to understand how information flows through online networks, and the fact that it's trying to understand, you know, what information is true and what's false. And, you know, it's definitely very important during a time of emergency. So, you know, going on with COVID-19, the fact that we've seen a lot of different information flowing around, you know, saying like, this, if you take such and such, you are immune from, you know, the disease. You know, that could be true, that could be false. You know, it's trying to pick out which information is true and what information should be out there. So I think it's definitely a very interesting model and a very interesting weak signal, because it will definitely showcase how to try and collectively understand what information is true and what information isn't true. Because I think it's in a world where this is occurring, it needs to happen. because, you know, I've looked at COVID-19. I've looked at all this, what's going on right now. It's very difficult to understand what's true and what's not. Even during an election campaign, you know, certain facts are true and certain facts are not, you know. So it's very interesting, model to look into, on a way of, you know, trying to understand, yeah, what's going to happen, what's going to impact it. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts, John, about this?
Yeah. On what you said, I think another big thing about it is that they also said they have identified an algorithm that can identify where in the network is the best place to release information so it can reach people most effectively. So it can replace the old stuff most quickly. So on the one hand, that's really good if you want to, you know, make sure that, say, you know, health authorities can get their information out most quickly to dispel any kind of rumors or disinformation out there. But on the other hand, that can be quite dangerous, because this doesn't necessarily dictate what is true and what is false. All it says is this is how long it takes for this piece of information to be replaced by an updated one, whether that is true information or whether that is an updated, you know, whether it's updated misinformation.
Yeah,
that's the question. So that algorithm could be used, you know, it can be used in very positive ways to ensure that the correct information gets out to people who need it. But knowing where to release information so it affects the most people, that's a very dangerous algorithm to give to trolls and to, you know, and to those who do have malicious intent.
I feel like I was having a bit of an online discussion actually with someone just about this issue in general. And I feel like maybe having a democratic body that's been elected to deal with issues like misinformation or disinformation, and maybe even giving this body this type of software, you know, so that they can, this is the thing, because everyone has different biases and things like that. And it's very difficult to try and stop these kind of biases and to circulate what information is true, what information is not. So maybe just giving this sort of software to one body and that's it, and they are elected, could be a way. But I don't know, it's very difficult.
Well, that's the thing, is you can't control, like, all it takes is for one person to, you know, leak that algorithm, or, you know, if researchers at North Carolina can do it, then certainly someone else somewhere can make a similar algorithm on their own.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not like that's the thing about software, is it's not something that can be so jealously guarded.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I think, yeah, this week's signal and your week's signal is very interesting to pose for the future. So I think we're just going to stop for there. Thanks John for coming to this conversation about agriculture and doing about these week's signals. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. You can find the rest of our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Until then, you can see us next week. So yeah, thanks very much, guys, and stay tuned for next.